Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host. We're visiting with four outstanding contributors to what I think of the war for the free world. We'll start with Tom Shanker. He is an accomplished and highly regarded journalist with the New York Times, where he serves as their Pentagon correspondent, having served in a number of other capacities for both the Times and other newspapers, including a lot of time in covering foreign affairs from overseas. And Tom, one of the pieces that you've written most recently jumped out at me as an important moment to sort of take stock with you. You were writing about the Army Chief of Staff, General Ray Ordiano, giving a kind of pep talk to American troops in Germany recently. Give us a quick reprise of what that pep talk was about, and then let's get into sort of, as I say, the ground truth of what's happening with our armed forces.
Well, of course, Frank, and once again, thanks for asking me on your program. It's an honor to join you and all of your listeners. I spent a week with General Ordiano, a three-time commander in Iraq who's now the Army's top officer. We were traveling in Germany, which is really a microcosm of everything happening to the Army today. I mean, throughout the Cold War, there was no more, dangerous spot than the folded gap in Central Europe, and Army forces were standing off against the Red Army. And today, that 200,000-strong Army in Europe has been cut to 40,000, and some of the biggest reductions as the Army fights to trim its budget will be in Europe. They'll drop to about 20,000 as the Army tries to figure out both what its mission is going ahead after 10 years of intense ground combat, and also trying to figure out how it keeps its best and brightest enlisted personnel, non-commissioned officers, and officers at a time when the Army really is trying to understand what it's for.
Yeah, and among the units that apparently will be coming out are armored. Was it brigades that they'll be taking down out of Europe and replacing them? Well, not replacing them. They'll not be even removed back to the States, as I understand it. They'll be simply decommissioned. Is that the idea?
That's exactly right. Two armored brigades will rotate through Afghanistan, and when they finish their time there, their flags will be furled. They will vanish off the Army books. And as you can imagine, Frank, this is incredibly unsettling, not just for the soldiers, but for their families. Yes, they'll likely have jobs somewhere else, but where is still to be determined. And also very angry in all of this were members of Congress who, when they heard that two brigades were coming out of Europe, they wanted them for their home districts, of course, and they weren't too happy to hear that those brigades are going nowhere.
Yeah. Well, and it'll be interesting to see how many of those guys actually do find jobs elsewhere. Let's talk, Tom Shanker, about what's, as I say, kind of happening to the armed forces more generally at the moment. A couple of things that are sort of top of my mind that give rise in the judgment of a lot of senior military fellows that I've talked with, many of whom served under previous administrations, is a return to a kind of hollowed out military, with the reset of forces that is so urgently needed, as from the punishment that the existing equipment has been taking in Afghanistan and Iraq as well, to canceling or stretching out the modernization of forces, to shrinking the numbers of troops, as we were just talking about. How serious a concern is that what we're looking at is a hollowed force, and what would the implications, Tom Shanker, be in your estimation should we go there?
Well, I can tell you, Frank, on the way home from Europe, I spent an hour with General Ordiano on his plane in an on-the-record interview, and he said that that's exactly one of his greatest concerns, and he has vowed that he will match personnel numbers to combat units to available equipment so that every unit that's supposed to be able to fight has enough soldiers to fight and all the proper gear. To make that work, though, may very well require eliminating even more brigade combat teams than have been announced thus far, or at least reorganizing them internally. But he has vowed that this risk of a hollow force is not going to happen on his watch. Mm.
So the idea being that hollowing translates into having people that don't have their kit. He's going to resolve that by having only as much personnel as there is kit to go around. But again, Tom, does it trouble you as a close observer for the New York Times, of course, but for all of us through your writing, of what you're seeing happening in the military, that the kit may not be up to scratch, that it certainly may not be as modern as it should be, given some of the threats that are emerging around the world?
Well, I mean, if you think about, you know, what is the Army's signature tool? It's the main battle tank. You know, after 10 years of heavy combat in the deserts and mountains of the Middle East, most of the Army's armored gear is worn out. They have a lot of MRAP, that mine-resistant vehicles, that are not applicable elsewhere. And there's not even a new tank or a vehicle that's in the budget. So they'll be having to deal with these older weapons to be refitted and retooled for a long time. I think one of the challenges is just as great as the equipment, though, Frank, is how you reset the people. I mean, after 10 years of being a deployed force, doing these missions for real in life or death situations, how do you evolve that army back to a garrison force? How do you keep the training vital and realistic? How do you keep young officers excited when they've been commanding in battle space and they come home to mostly be just paper pushers?
Right. Always a hard transition to make. I guess my concern as much as that, Tom, is that we may find ourselves in new conflicts, and they may have been disengaged or alienated or simply let go. The kit allowed to sort of atrophy, and we will be the worse for wear if that happens. Let me turn, if I can, quickly, Tom, in the remaining time we have. And again, we're speaking with Tom Shanker of the New York Times. He is their Pentagon correspondent. He is a man who has written on these sorts of issues for decades. He is also the co-author with Eric Schmidt of a book called Counter-Strike, which details the war that we've been in for some time now. And speaking of Eric, he has a front-page story in the Times today, Tom Shanker, about kind of a post-mortem, if I can use that expression, on what happened over the weekend in Afghanistan. Can you share with us kind of what you think that reporting suggests is going on, specifically with respect to this Taliban sort of subsidiary called the Haqqani Network, and what it means for the war effort there?
Right. The Haqqani Networks is certainly one of the historic Mujahideen family clan militia organizations. They're part insurgency, they're part criminal cartel, they're part real estate, drug smugglers, timber smugglers, and they're the ones blamed for the day-long spectacular attacks in Kabul, the Afghan capital, earlier this week.
And among other places, I think there were
among
a total
other places,
of seven attacks,
right? Yes, all across the eastern provinces. You know, Admiral Mullen, the former chairman before he retired last year, said that the Haqqani Network was operating as a virtual arm of Pakistani intelligence. And even though that's, you know, certainly a view that's widely held across the government, you know, dealing with the Haqqanis is very, very difficult. They have safe haven in Pakistan. They operate, as we can see, with impunity in eastern Afghanistan. The question, Frank, though, is whether they can generate this kind of attack regularly. In the past, they've mostly been able to do this sort of coordinated multi-prong attack only a couple of times a year. As the spring offensive starts in Afghanistan, it's going to be very telling whether the Haqqanis mount another attack, because what's important about the Haqqanis to remember, all of the negotiations for reconciliation with the Quetta-Shura Taliban, the traditional Taliban under Mullah Omar, thus far the Haqqanis have not participated, and it's really unclear whether they'll come to the table in the same way that the older Taliban might.
Yeah. Well, again, Tom Shanker, the question that occurs to me is, are we, in fact, witnessing these guys sensing the wind at their back and that there's no particular need for them to come to the negotiating table except perhaps to accept, our surrender? And that's the worrying thing is that when General Dempsey, just very quickly, Tom, in Eric Schmidt's piece this morning, says that the attacks are clearly tied to Haqqani but not to Pakistan, I'm wondering how that could be. What, very quickly, would your answer be?
Well, without a doubt, the Haqqanis live and operate in a safe haven in Pakistan. I think what he was saying is that these attacks were probably organized by the cells based in the Regional Command East section of Afghanistan. I don't think that the chairman would ever say that the Haqqanis were not sort of living and working freely in the Pakistani tribal
areas. That's been the problem, of course, is the safe haven there. Tom Shanker, we have to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us. Tom is, again, a co-author with Eric Schmidt of Counterstrike, the Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. Tom, we'll have you back soon if we can, please, to visit a bit further on this and other issues as they continue to unfold. Thanks for the work you're doing at the New York Times, and come back to us again soon.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Michelle Bachmann joins us to talk about the idea of putting North Korea back on the terrorism list. Sounds like a good idea to me. Straight ahead.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of 3 children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a 5th grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a 5-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, the Threat to America at amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying we're serious about really cutting the budget
as a backdrop
to this debate about 2011. People make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by one of my favorite members of the United States House of Representatives, an all-star, particularly in the aftermath of her national exposure as a candidate for the presidency. Her name is, of course, Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. She represents the 6th District of Minnesota and has done so since 2007, having served prior to that in the Minnesota State Senate for 6 years. She is a member of the House Intelligence Committee, which is of direct relevance to the topics that we cover here, and also of the Financial Services Committee in the House of Representatives. And it's always a treat to have her with us. And Michelle, welcome back. Great to be able to talk with you about a couple of really important things that are happening in the security policy space, and you're one of the few national politicians these days, I think, who's really paying attention to it, and I commend you for that.
Well, Frank, thank you so much. This is an issue, the issue of national security and maintaining the United States sovereignty, that is not being addressed in the manner that it should on the national stage. Quite rightly, we're focused on jobs and the economy, but we can't keep our focus on that to the detriment of national security. And I think just events that have transpired this week alone let us know that the presidential race needs to be about this discussion as well. So thank you, Frank, for emphasizing this issue too.
Well, it is of such importance, and not least because if things go badly in the world, national security is threatened. One of the surefire things that will flow from that, as you know so well, Congressman Bachman, is there will be implications for the economy, for trade, for jobs and the like, as well as just sheer additional risk. Let's talk about one of those threats that emerged in the space of the past couple of days. Some are taking comfort from the fact that the latest North Korean missile launch fizzled, as have several before that. Should we take such comfort? And to what extent do you think this threat really requires additional action on the part of our government?
Well, I think we can be thankful that the missile launch was a failure. It failed about 2 minutes into the launch. And what we need to know is that this was a direct slap in the face of the United States. And what we need to wake up and recognize is that rogue nations like North Korea no longer respect economic and superpower military status that the United States has historically enjoyed in past decades. I think what this recognizes is this was a thumbing of the nose against the United States. We, in good faith in the United States, lifted North Korea away from being on our list of state sponsors of terror. And after this missile launch on Sunday, I have called again for Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and the president to put North Korea back on the list of state sponsors of terror. It's a very short list. There are only four nations that are listed. North Korea was the fifth nation. Among those include such notorious characters as Cuba, as Iran, and we in Sudan. We also need to now re-add back to that list North Korea, because they've proved that in no way we in good faith took them off that list, but they are now no longer in the category of acting in good faith. They now need to be added onto that list, and we need to withdraw from North Korea inducements for good behavior, i.e. money, and we need to let them pay a little bit of a penalty box, like a whole lot of penalty box, for this rogue action.
Right. Not least, I think, because building and testing missiles capable of reaching our shores with nuclear weapons, which they also have, and, of course, their willingness to sell such missiles and perhaps weapons as well to others really qualifies as acts of terrorism, I think, by any reasonable definition. I hope, Congressman Michelle Bachman.
Absolutely, it does. And I love the phrase by Mark Stein, the columnist. He calls North Korea the Walmart of missile nuclear weapon development systems.
Nukes
and
are us.
Really, in some ways, what they were trying to do is show their customers their wares. Now, they lost a lot of face that Sunday morning, but they showed that they definitely are open for business to rogue nations, and the world cannot tolerate a North Korea with the ambitions that they've demonstrated.
Congressman Bachman, I noted that you're a member of the Financial Services Commission. I wondered if you have given some thought to a recommendation that's been made on our air a number of times in recent days, namely the idea of not only putting these guys back on the terrorism list, which I think makes a lot of sense, but also reestablishing sanctions that really got their attention a few years back. The Bush administration went after them because they were counterfeiting our currency and essentially cut off the banking system, not only the North Koreans, but others who were doing business with them in connection with the so-called Banco Delta Asia business. How do you feel about that idea, and could it be effective now?
I agree with those sanctions. I think imposing those sanctions on any bank, company, or government agency complicit in nuclear proliferation is the way that we must go.
Speaking of which, there's been an effort made, of course, through sanctions to curb the appetites of Iran for a nuclear weapon. We had a set of negotiations over the weekend in Turkey to that end. The administration is now saying that they're going to go back to the negotiating table about 6 weeks from now. Israel's obviously getting frantic about this. You were in Israel recently. You saw missiles launched, rockets perhaps launched at Israeli cities. What is your take on the advisability of this seemingly open-ended negotiation at a moment when an existential threat to Israel for sure, and maybe to us as well, is emerging?
The decision was a terrible mistake because the signal sent to Iran is that we aren't a serious player. We want to continue to give them another pass at negotiations. This will buy Iran another 5-6 weeks of unimpeded enrichment of uranium. This cannot continue. What we should have done is drawn a line in the sand and said, today, Iran must cease all uranium enrichment, and they must surrender the uranium that they have enriched now. They must open all facilities immediately to UN inspection, including the ones that have been off limits historically. It has to end, and none of those signals come from the Obama administration. And so I think behind closed doors, we see the Iranian leadership laughing at the United States because we are sending signals of a paper tiger, not the signals of a military superpower.
Yeah, and the willingness to execute an ultimatum like that is obviously lacking in, as you say, giving rise to a perception of weakness and irresolution. Let me ask you on another question. You've been spending a lot of time, I know, as a member of the Intelligence Committee, Congressman Michelle Bachmann, trying to make sure you understand what's going on with the Muslim Brotherhood. The Obama administration is also making, I think, a terrible mistake here, but romancing, embracing, engaging, underwriting now even the Muslim Brotherhood. We're at a moment when the purpose of the Brotherhood, in Egypt most obviously, is clearly to bring Sharia to the world. I keep hearing about people concerned about women and the women's vote in this election and a war on women. I can't imagine a more serious war on women than allowing Sharia to come to the United States with the help of the Brotherhood. What's going on here, and what would you recommend we do as a nation about the Muslim Brotherhood and its ascendancy?
There's a gross misunderstanding of Sharia, I think, among many people in the United States, or they are simply ignorant of the implications, in particular to women. One thing that we learned from Sharia is that women are viewed as less than chattel. In many cases, they're viewed as less than the value of a dog. I've had some Muslim women tell me that they're viewed with the same contempt as dirt. And so women are seen in a light that we don't even understand in the United States. And so this isn't just about tolerance for another religion's views. This is about abuse of women and tolerating abuse of women. That should never occur in the United States, whether it's honor killings or whether it's the demeaning of women or not allowing women to testify or make contracts. There are any number of elements of Sharia law that are completely opposed to our United States Constitution, because men and women are equal under the American Constitution. Under Sharia, men and women are not equal. And Sharia is a law that seeks to supersede the Constitution of the United States. We need to take this threat very seriously because Sharia abides no competition, including the Constitution of the United States.
Yeah, and I think you've said it so well. The additional point I would just make is that clearly what you're dealing with here is a political as well as legal program. And as a result, it does not warrant or deserve, at any rate, the kinds of protection that a religion does. And I think getting that right about Sharia is critical, and I commend you for doing so. Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, I hope that what you've just said will, in fact, be picked up on by a number of your colleagues on the Hill, and that there will be much more intensive oversight in this area. And I know if there is, it will be thanks to your leadership. Thank you for spending some time with us, Congressman Bachmann, and for the work that you're doing to raise awareness, not only in your own 6th District of Minnesota, but around the country, about the importance of these national security issues. We are very pleased to have you with us and hope you'll be willing to come back to us again very soon.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, parents. Finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi, son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
I'll pick you up after school. Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by one of my all-time favorite people, Deborah Burlingame. She has, in the years since 9/11, emerged as one of America's most articulate, thoughtful, and courageous opponents of jihadism in this country. She came to that not because she sought this mission, but because her brother, Chick Burlingame, had been murdered in the course of doing his duty. He was flying American Airlines Flight 77 on September 11th, 2001, when his plane was hijacked and flown into the Pentagon. by Al-Qaeda jihadists. Deborah Burlingame has gone on to many important things, including founding a terrific group called 9/11 Families for a Safe and Strong America, and also Keep America Safe. Deborah Burlingame, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's been too long. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Frank. It's always good to talk to you.
Thanks. Well, there's a lot to talk about, sadly. And part of what I really wanted to visit most with you about was something we've been talking a fair about recently, because it's emerging as more and more of a problem. And that is not simply what the Muslim Brotherhood, as the organization that, as you know, is the principal impetus behind much of this jihadism around the world these days, in Egypt, but also what's going on with it here. And I'd just like to get, you know, sort of your calibration on who these guys are and whether those who say, oh, no, they're moderates, they're nonviolent, they're just into humanitarian good works, we can do business with them, actually know what they're talking about, and if they don't, what the implications might be.
Well, first of all, it's very important to understand that they are not, as our own Director of National Intelligence said, James Clapper said, a largely secular group.
Yeah.
They were formed back in the 20s and outlawed, sent into exile because they wanted to their government in Egypt to hew to the book, to Sharia law.
Mm-hmm.
And their logo has a cross swords. Their motto is one of jihad and religious intolerance. I think it is Allah is our objective, Prophet is our leader, the Prophet is our leader, the Quran is our law, jihad is our way, and dying in the way of Allah is our highest hope.
Mm-hmm.
They're
hard to construe that as either secular or nonviolent,
right?
Isn't it?
And you know, their spiritual leader Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who you know has a platform on Al Jazeera. His own program there. He's their announced spiritual leader who makes no bones about the fact that the point of the Muslim Brotherhood is worldwide dominance, Muslim supremacy. And if they can't get it through non-violent means, then jihad is most definitely the next step. But make no mistake, the idea that they are, quote, moderate, that just means that they're willing to try conversion and infiltration first before they go for the hard stuff of terrorism.
And in fact, that's very much, as you know, Deborah Burlingame, the phased plan that they're following is to use these other what they've called civilization jihad techniques,
right,
as the precursor to getting to the point where you can actually do the violent bit. Okay, so with that as background, we've got the Director of National Intelligence, and he, in fairness, he kind of walked the cat back a little bit.
Only because he had to.
Yeah,
because it was untenable.
but nonetheless, that certainly seems to be informing, that misunderstanding, informing the Obama administration's views towards these guys. And in part, Deborah Burlingame, I guess one of the things that I most value your insights into is how badly they are mistaking the company they're keeping, not just by embracing these guys in Egypt, but here. Tell us a little bit about the Muslim Brotherhood infrastructure in America and the mistake it amounts to be embracacing these guys,
right,
all Muslims.
Well, they laid it all out in their American settlement documents that were discovered in an FBI raid in 2004. Those documents were admitted into evidence in the biggest material support terrorism trial in the history of the United States back in 2007.
The Holy Land Foundation trial, right?
The Holy Land Foundation trial. And that lays out their entire plan to infiltrate every aspect of American society, our institutions, our cultural institutions, our educational institutions, the media, government, the military. The idea is to, you know, get their hooks, lay down roots into American society. They do it behind the shield of, you know, enlightenment, diversity, multiculturalism.
Bridge building.
Bridge building. Yes. And by the way, when you see the term or read the term bridge building, that should be a red flag for you. Because they are Bell used that term. Remember, it was, quote, Bridges TV. The founder of Bridges TV in Connecticut is the guy who beheaded his wife.
Right.
That television station was supposed to be about, you know, educating the public on, you know, how docile and friendly, you know, Islam is. Mm. But the whole concept is to infiltrate our civilization and bring down the house of the infidel by our own hand. In other words, we will enable them.
Right.
And we
to destroy us from within, I think, is their
exact
formulation.
Exactly.
Okay, so Deborah,
you can go back several presidents to see members of Muslim Brotherhood right in the picture frame with them, mm-hmm. Whether it was Bill Clinton or George Bush, mm-hmm. or our current president, mm-hmm. Barack Obama.
Yes, absolutely. So, Deborah, one of the ways in which we're seeing this Muslim Brotherhood infrastructure that has now been established, going back, I guess, to 1963, I think it was, when they founded the Muslim Students Association. But they're sort of swarming at the moment in a very virulent way to attack a guy that I know you've worked with, as have I over the years, and admire, I think, as much as I do, Dr. Zudi Jasser. He's been appointed, we talked with him last week on the show, he has been appointed to the U.S. International Religious Freedom Commission. Why are they doing this to Zudi, and should they be allowed to get away with driving him off of this commission?
Well, they're doing it to Zudi because he represents a clear threat to their, to not only to their existence, but before that, to their narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Their narrative of, you know, grievance and Islamophobia in America, and their claim that they represent Muslims in this country, peace-loving, a democracy-embracing Muslims. That is the narrative that they have put out. And they don't like Zudi to enter into that, into the picture frame with them, because Zudi is not only an authentic Muslim who, the son of Syrian immigrants, who came to this country, embraced the American project, embraces secularism, the separation of mosque and state. But also, you know, this is a guy who was a Navy commander, and a physician. He's a professional, and he is a prolific writer and, a very, articulate thinker on these subjects. And he's someone who can engage with them on the subject of Sharia and out them for their lies, yes, and their misrepresentations. And so they don't want to get on panels with him. They don't want him to be able to refute what they say and do.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is that I think they know that most Muslims who come to this country for economic freedom, or even religious freedom, because they have more freedom
to get away from Sharia
countries, and to get away from Sharia,
right.
They support Zudi. I've met Muslims, and by the way, Zudi is a friend. My organization supported him and his American Islamic Leadership Coalition that came out recently in a press conference to support the NYPD,
right.
Which is under fire from these same Muslim
same
groups.
Same guys, exactly.
We supported Zudi and these leaders. We know, my organization knows, because we've talked to, you know, ordinary Muslims who are fearful to come out,
mm-hmm.
and do things like support the NYPD, fearful to come out and condemn people like Major Hassan, the Fort Hood shooter, to condemn terrorist attacks here and around the world, because
the
they will be targeted by organizations like,
yeah,
CARE and MPAC, yeah, and MSA.
Yeah. Deborah, we've got to let you go. This is very important stuff, needless to say. Your insights into it, your support for people like Zudi Jasser, and your leadership more generally, really since, you know, the smoke was still clearing on 9/11, has been deeply appreciated by, I think, all of us who love this country. And I really appreciate you taking a few minutes to be with us, and keep up the great work at Keep America Safe and in your 9/11 family's context, and come back to us again very soon.
I will. Thank you, Frank.
Next up, Andy McCarthy joins us for our weekly roundup with him, and we'll talk a little bit about Anders Breivik and other developments of import. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medications, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call. And I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of 3 children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a 5th grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a 5-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and
listen to the Gospel. I just got to stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC, New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need, and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. The high point of our week really is our chance to visit with Andy McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, author of Willful Blindness and the Grand Jihad, of countless essays of extraordinary quality at National Review Online, and not least, a man who shares with us each week his insights into most especially the nexus between national security and law. And, Andy, as we speak, there is a drama playing out in Norway involving a man by the name of Anders Breivik, who went on a rampage a while back for reasons that aren't, frankly, entirely clear. But he's seemingly, or others at least, are seemingly implicating a lot of people, well, like you and me, who have been warning about Sharia and the rise of those trying to impose it on the rest of us. What do you make of the trial that we've seen so far in Norway and what might be to come?
Well, I think the most outrageous thing I've seen so far about that, Frank, is the staggeringly small number of years he's facing in prison. I think if I remember what I read in the morning papers correctly, that for killing 77 people, he's looking at about 21 years in prison, which is, I hate to say, they think that's a harsh sentence in Europe. To me, that's the most outrageous part of it. As far as, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood and its front organization's campaign to try to make some grist out of a mass murderer's meanderings, you know, it's. I think people just ought to take that stuff from its source. These people are as predictable as the sun coming up in the morning.
Yeah, well, and unfortunately, there are some who do that, and there are some who don't do that, and unfortunately, the latter, especially in Europe, seem to be much more numerous. Andy, let me ask you this. You've been writing about, of course, both here and abroad, the sort of increasing aggressiveness of some of these Muslim Brotherhood characters, their fellow travelers, or their at least allies, one of whom is a fellow by the name of Nasir Ahmed in the United Kingdom, and you've just written a piece at National Review about him and some of his antics. Give us the backstory about who this character is and what he's been doing lately, and why.
Yeah, ironically known as Lord Ahmed.
Oh, yes, Lord Ahmed.
Yes.
Or, I guess, first, Lord Nasir to us, right?
Yes, the first. Well, I think they call him Lord Ahmed, although that may be a term of affection for all of us, right?
or just respect.
Yes. Well, he is the first Muslim member of Parliament as of 1998. He became a life peer during the campaign of Tony Blair, I guess, who has gotten wiser with age, but wasn't particularly wise when he first took power on this issue. But anyway, he was, as they tried to knock out the idea of a life peer as a sort of a hereditary thing and tried to bestow it on personages of prominence in British society or the British society they thought they wanted to have. Lord Ahmed became a member of the British House of Lords. He's a Pakistani native and, you know, still has very close ties to Islamist groups in Pakistan. He was front and center with our friend Geert Wilders as when the Brits, at about the same time, were rolling out the red carpet to Binyam Mohammed, one of the al-Qaeda people who were supposed to do the second wave of attacks in the United States. Him they wanted back. Geert Wilders, who was a Dutch parliamentarian, they closed the door on him, didn't want him in the country because he's somebody who speaks quite candidly and bluntly but with great eloquence on the unavoidable nexus between Islamic doctrine and acts of terrorism by Muslim jihadists. So that's up till now, I think that was the claim to fame internationally of Lord Ahmed, but he's now stepped into the big time. He's put a bounty out on the President of the United States and the former President of the United States, that's Obama and Bush, £10 million, I believe, which he did in reaction to the United States offering an award of $10 million for information leading to the capture of one of the leading terrorists in Pakistan. So that's his moral equivalence. And I think the most interesting thing out of it, Frank, we say this kind of stuff all the time, and I don't know how much attention people pay to it coming out of the mouths of non-Muslims, but I think this is a pretty clear indicator that Lord Ahmed, who is a member of the British government, does not look at the world as in the Western construct of Westphalian nation states. He's an emissary of the Muslim Ummah, And he's much more concerned with what he regards as an insult to the Ummah, that is this 10 million pound reward, or $10 million reward for the capture of a jihadist. He's much more concerned with what he takes that to be, the insult to the Ummah, than he is, it seems, in representing what's best for the people.
Yeah. And unfortunately, this is, I'm afraid, something that we've seen, I'm sure not in every case, but in a number of cases of members of parliament or, for that matter, members of Congress that brought to their mandate this idea that they've got to stand with their Muslim brothers. And whether it's in Israel or whether it's in Washington, D.C., it complicates, needless to say, the kind of clarity that is needed for these nation states, as you say, to protect themselves against a great and present and growing danger. As you have documented probably as well, if not considerably better than just about anybody, Andy McCarthy is again our guest, author, among other things, of The Grand Jihad, which is what this is all about, folks. Andy, let me use the remaining minutes we have with you to talk a bit about Afghanistan. We spoke earlier in the program with Tom Shanker of the New York Times about this recent attack that was considered to be, I guess, in some respects, kind of a Tet offensive kind of effort by the Taliban or the Haqqani network to demonstrate they're in the game, they're able to strike with impunity even in very secure areas. Could you speak about that a little bit, and also, if you would, as to whether you think there's any connection, even indirectly, to the deal that was struck last week, I believe it was, between the United States government and the Afghan government about night raids, restricting basically our ability to conduct them?
Well, I think to take the second part first, Frank, I think the night raids, whether or not they're connected to the Taliban offensive, are offensive to us in their own right. But they, to the extent they may be fueling the, this idea that we need to go to Taliban authorities and perhaps even Sharia judges to get permission to conduct warfare in a place where Congress has authorized us to fight war. I think to the extent that it affects the Taliban at all, it's yet one more indicator that, we have forces who are present in Afghanistan, but they don't seem to be doing anything in terms of a permanent furthering of American national security interests. And
won't be allowed to, for that matter, right?
No, well, that's exactly right, of course. But I saw somebody said that the Taliban. I think it was an article I saw in the Middle East Quarterly, which was terrific this time around, about strategy in Afghanistan. And the Taliban's motto is the Americans have the watches, we have the time. When you tell them that you're leaving and you do everything in the meantime while you're there to basically push yourself further and further away from the day-to-day reality of what's going on there, obviously that's going to, if you have an aggressive enemy like the Taliban, that's going to whet their appetite and indicate to them that more aggression is going to be rewarded. I personally don't think that what we're doing in Afghanistan has made sense for a number of years, but I think if you're going to be there, then you say that the Taliban is the enemy and you try to defeat them. And if you're not going to do that, then I don't know why we're there.
Yep. Sensible thoughts as always. Andy McCarthy, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for joining us. Keep up the good work at National View Online, as always, and in the many other outlets in which you are contributing to the fight, including to this one, of course. We'll look forward to talking with you next week and to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Do you want the big picture on national security and foreign policy? Find out what Ronald Reagan meant by peace through strength at securefreedomradio.org. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.